Where there is cinnabar above, yellow gold will be found below. Where there is lodestone above, copper and gold be found below. Where there is calamine above, lead, tin, and red copper will be found below. Where there is hematite above, iron will be found below. Thus it can be seen that mountains are full of riches. Guan Zhong. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I am your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. If you're a newcomer, welcome. I hope you enjoy. I hope you'll listen to any backlog episodes that strike your fancy or seem interesting to you. And if you're a returning listener, again, thank you as always. I've been really happy basically since the start of the year. Things have been, you know, steadily going up. It's nice to see the shows continuing to grow and even growing at a faster pace than normal. Again, thank you all. So we're going to go ahead and jump into the topic of this week's episode. And as you can guess from the title, it is about metallurgy. I had been debating whether just to go straight into urbanization and then talk about metallurgy. But I was looking through my notes and I was trying to find kind of what I wanted to talk about. And I'd like to go in a little bit more detail and be a little bit more, I guess maybe philosophical about urbanization and the birth of cities. So I decided, well, let's just go something that's a little bit more straightforward when talking about metallurgy. And this episode, it might end up being two parts. I'm kind of going to start and just go over certain, I guess, the materials and information about them. And then, depending on how long that takes, we might go ahead and move directly into, techniques involved with metallurgy and molding these metals and things like that. But if this gets a little longer than I expect it to, we might break this into a two-parter, so we'll have to wait and see. But for now, let's just go ahead and dive into this week's topic. So, to start, we should go probably all the way back to the last episode of Season 1. That's the one where I went over the Three Ages naming convention. Stone, Bronze, and Iron Ages. That was invented by the Danish, archaeologist/museum director C.J. Thompson. And how he devised that kind of naming convention, timing convention, when he was categorizing European history, or at least archaeological finds in Europe. And we talked about the strengths of the convention and its weaknesses, and we also talked about how different parts of the world entered these phases at different times, when they entered them. Not everywhere would have these quite as distinctive phases. Thompson was, of course, influenced by classical Roman and Greek literature, and he worked with the information he had. Excavations in the early 1800s either hadn't found much copper, or they lumped it in with later bronze artifacts. The Roman author, Lucretius, lists both an Iron Age, he lists like an age of bronze and an age of iron, but he doesn't separate copper from either of them, I don't believe. At least from what I remember, I haven't read Lucretius in a while. I read him once for a history of history class back in college. However, around 50 years or so after C.J. Thompson kind of introduced this naming convention, a number of scholars with new information had begun to argue that there was a transitional period between the Stone and Bronze Ages. The first of these men was the Hungarian scientist Ferenc Puszki, and I apologize for any Hungarians that may be listening if I butchered that name. In the 1870s, he found some very large artifacts made completely from copper, just pure copper. And this led to him proposing the possibility of a prehistoric period between the Bronze Age and the Stone Age. And around a decade or so later, the Englishman, John Evans, future Sir John Evans, put forward his argument for a transitional period between the Stone and Bronze Ages. He used literary evidence and linguistic evidence from areas that... he used literary evidence and linguistics from Europe, but he also pulled in evidence from areas that most European scientists were ignoring. He looked at actual artifacts found in the Americas and China to show that in every one of these places, use of copper always came before the use of bronze. Now, in English, the hypothetical period was popularly called the Copper Age. I don't think Evans gave it a name, but he obviously understood that copper was the driving force of tool making in that age. Though we'll talk about how that may or may not be correct shortly. Though there were those that liked to use the more scientific chalcolithic. Which was a combination of the Greek for copper, chalcos, and stone. But he didn't have as much in the way of physical evidence to back him up, or to back himself up as Ferenc, though. But a couple of years after Sir John Evans's paper, an Italian archaeologist, Gaetano Chirici, found the Rimadello culture. And they'll show up next season when we talk about Italy. But when he was talking about the material culture and what he had found, he said that they showed a clear, and this is a quote, a clear, quote, period of transition from the age of stone to that of bronze, end quote. Now, this site would show a 1,000-year period of copper use before bronze even shows up in the record, and much less becomes the primary metal. Now, Chirici created a Neo-Latin term, meaning the stone to bronze period, ennio, meaning bronze, and lithic, meaning stone. Hence, Neolithic, or Enneolithic, depending on the pronunciation of how you wanted to do that Latin. So today, Chalcolithic, Neolithic, Enneolithic, or Copper Age are all used in English to mean the same thing, though by definition they are technically mean slightly different things / periods. Though there is one little bit of interesting information in regards to Sir John Evans. His son Arthur would also be knighted as Sir Arthur Evans for his role in the rediscovery of the Minoan civilization on Crete. So a very learned and lettered family there. So, again, all these terms can mean the same thing, but the people who were using them were talking about slightly different things from each other. But generally, in the round, I guess, by and large, they mostly were talking about the same type of era. Though, again, depending on where you lived, this age may or may not have existed. As we'll talk about, there isn't a lot of use, at least so far, we haven't found much evidence of an independent copper age in Africa. They kind of went directly from stone to iron, although there are some people who disagree with that. But generally speaking, there is no firm evidence that copper was used on its own before iron. And of course, bronze is an alloy of copper and tin. There were no sources of tin, at least in the western sub-Saharan portion of Africa. So for sub-Saharan Africa, at least, even if they had a copper age, they did not have a true bronze age. Bronze doesn't show up there until after they have already begun utilizing iron. But that's all stuff we'll talk about in future episodes. Now, I talked about the origin of copper in English when talking about the potential origin of the name of Cyprus. But to recap and expand, copper appeared in Old English as copper and evolved from the Proto-Germanic cupar. This was derived from a later Latin term, cuprum, which was kind of a contraction of ace cyprium, or the metal of Cyprus, which Cyprus is a major source of copper in the ancient world. And it's going to be very important in the historical period, as we'll see, for that very reason, and some other reasons as well. Now, ace originally referred to copper itself, but then after time it began just to mean metal or ore in general. And this came from a Proto-Indo-European word that could have been ios or eos or heos, depending on, you know, which reconstruction you follow. Now, copper, of course, is on the periodic table of elements, and it has the atomic number 29. Its chemical symbol Cu comes from the Cu of cuprum. It is a transition metal, and it rests in period 4 and group 11. Period 4 is home to copper and 17 other elements, including iron, calcium, nickel. Group 11 is also home to gold and silver. Excuse me. Now, period 4 has no unstable elements, and all the metals in the group are very strong, sturdy. And all of group 11's metals, minus ruthenium, which is one that was, I believe, created artificially, but gold, silver, copper, they are all naturally in a metallic state or a native state. This means that the ore is available without any minerals or rocks mixed in, and chemical reactions don't have to be done to extract the metal or turn the material into metal. Of course, though, that isn't to say you cannot find these elements mixed in other states or mixed in with other minerals or that other types of ores or things like that. In fact, finding them in mixed company, I guess for lack of a better term, is probably one of the reasons that mining and metallurgy and, you know, all the kind of tasks associated with all those exists. Because we wanted more and more of these metals, we found newer and newer ways to find more and more usable amounts from known sources, as well as searching for unknown sources. In some cases, these attempts to pull more valuable resources from these mixed deposits led to discoveries or innovations that were not planned. Now, in addition to copper, the first metals used by humans were gold and iron, at least sort of, when we talk about iron, but we'll talk about gold first. Gold first appeared in Old English as gold, from a Proto-Germanic golthan. This probably came from a Proto-Indo-European word sounding something like gel, which translates to something similar to shine. The Latin term for gold was aurum, and this came from the Proto-Italic ausum. And this term also came from Proto-Indo-European, which sounded something like eusum. And the root of this term was eus. And this could mean dawn or become light or red. And some considered gold to have a reddish tint. And this can happen. Gold can have a reddish tint. And this was due to this can happen due to a number of environmental factors. And in fact, you can make red gold by mixing gold and copper together in a certain ratio. And it's very possible that the earliest gold that these Proto-Indo-European speakers were running across were found with copper kind of mixed in. And note the similarity of this Heus with the pi root of ace. They're very similar. And they're probably, that's, again, shows that they're related. Now, the Latin aurum is where gold gets its chemical symbol Au. Its atomic number is 79. Gold is also a transition metal, and as mentioned, is in group 11 with copper and silver, but it is also in period 6. And period 6 includes lead, platinum, and mercury. Now, the inclusion of the next metal might be confusing, and it is debatable that it should even be taught about this season, but I believe it should be. And that metal is iron, or rather a very specific type of iron alloy known as meteoric iron. If you're interested in learning about why and how these naturally occurring alloys happened or formed, I recommend Googling protoplanetary disk and primitive rocks. And you can kind of study like the long history of planet formation and stellar bodies and all that kind of stuff. But again, meteoric iron is actually a naturally occurring alloy. It's primarily iron and nickel, though there can be other trace elements too. And there are also cases of a pure or native iron existing on its own, with just the iron itself. And that doesn't need to be smelted from ore, like iron usually does. But it is extremely rare to find native iron. Because of course, as everyone is aware, iron rusts. And as far as I saw from research, none of this pure native iron was in use anywhere in the world, at least during this season. Now, iron first appears in Middle English after evolving from the Old English Eirin, which comes from the Old Saxon Isran, which is from the Proto-Germanic Isarn. Now, it's possible that this word entered Proto-Germanic from Celtic. They used Isarnum. The Pi word, or the Proto-Indo-European word, that iron is derived from would be Iseral, or Iseral, which meant strong. And it would make iron, if you took it literally, it would mean iron is a strong or powerful or even holy metal. Some people believe that Isro also meant holy. The Latin word for iron is ferrum, hence the chemical symbol Fe. Where this word originated from is not known. There are some theories. Some believe it may have been adopted from Etruscan or possibly from Phoenician. The Greek etymology for the word is also a mystery. They used sidaros, and the closest word that you could get from other Proto-Indo-European languages is the Latin word sidus, which meant constellation or meteorite, with this possibly also being related to a Proto-Indo-European suede, which meant to sweat. And that's where the Latin word sudor, which is sweat or moisture, comes from. And in ancient Greek, it's hydros, which is sweat or perspiration. So, all in all, this kind of shows that iron was not in wider use until after Pi had started to branch out, or at least branched out far more than it had with copper and gold. And again, it's not clear that the Cedros or Cetus, and it's not clear that those have any relation to iron. Maybe like on some metaphysical level, you could say that like iron is like sweat from the sky or something like that, but that's a stretch in my opinion. I don't think there's any way to kind of back that up. Now, as I talked about, meteoric iron is an alloy, and I'm going to hold off on giving its elemental properties for this episode. Also, I debated including silver in this, but silver, as far as I can tell, doesn't really show up until, at least in human usage, until around 3400 BC, give or take. We do have earlier, much earlier recorded interactions of humans using gold, copper, and meteoric iron, and that is very important. Meteoric iron is in use far earlier than any other metal, with the exception of copper and gold. So, gold, of course, we have the earliest evidence of human interaction with it. There has been findings of at least of cave drawings happening in caves where gold was present. Now, as far as I know, there's no evidence that this gold was worked or that humans attempted to work it. It may have just, you know, kind of stood out to them in the same way that, you know, like another shiny rock at maybe like quartz or something along those lines. Now, copper is where we have the earliest kind of evidence of like human attempts to change it in some way. I think the oldest right now is dated to northern Iraq, or what is now northern Iraq. And that could be as old as 9,000. It could be as recent as 7,000. Gold as a worked metal, like a kind of, you see the similar levels of craftsmanship, I don't think shows up until around 5,000-ish BC, somewhere between 5 and 4,000. Now, we should go ahead and point out that it is possible that these metals were being worked earlier than what we found in the archaeological record. I'm always of the opinion that just because we have found the oldest of something, it is not very likely that we have actually found the oldest or the first example of something happening. That's especially true with metal. Of course, one of the reasons metal begins to replace stone is because metal can be recycled and reused in a way that stone cannot be. In fact, copper and even iron aren't as hard as even some stones that humans have been using for far longer. For instance, using the Mohs hardness scale, flint I think is like a 7 or 7.5 out of 10. Copper is like 2.5 to 3, and iron's just like a 4. And even ordinary steel is only like a 5 at most on the Mohs hardness scale. But of course, flint being what it is, can easily chip, and it can continue to chip. And that may happen in some cases with metal, but the difference with metal is that you can smooth out those chips, or you can hammer it. If it's just dinged in, you can kind of hammer it back into place some, or eventually you'll get to the point where you can just melt it down, and in copper's case, recast it, or just forge it if it's iron or things like that. And it's also important to remember, just because copper, it's called the Copper Age, does not mean that stone disappears. Stone remains in use well into the historical period, well past the starts of the Bronze and even the Iron Age. It's only used for certain things. It's more of a specialty, but it's never completely gone away from use. In fact, these metals actually become a type of a prestige item in many cases. This is something that a person of great skill or status would have. This isn't something that your average worker is going to have. And that's something we'll talk about going forward, talking about the creation of civilization and sedentary societies and the advancement to just away from the simple family structures that we've talked about with hunter-gatherers. And it takes skill to create these tools or not just tools, but also jewelry, in the case of all of these metals, including iron. The earliest iron, meteoric iron items we have found were made into beads. That was it. They weren't used for any other thing. They were just polished up and designed for jewelry uses. But to really make use of metal as a tool, as a decoration, you actually have to work the metal much harder than you would stone. It requires more skill, or at least more learning to develop that skill, more dedication. In many cases, it was quicker just to nap yourself a stone axe as opposed to work like a metal tool. And that skill will eventually become very important if very prestigious metal workers will, in some cases, be seen almost as extensions of gods. In some cases, they may have some level of deification, as we'll talk about. But as for at least the earliest processes, these are not. There's very little involved in terms of fire, firing these tools, melting them down, casting them into shapes. That is not something that's happening. What they're first doing to shape this metal and make it usable is a process called cold working. And this involves techniques similar to what you would get when you're working a stone, napping, hammering, but it also involved things like they would try to squeeze it, maybe put it under a large stone and push down on the stone. They would occasionally rub kind of like a circular, like if you have like a thing of dough and you were like just rolling it into a ball like that, they would do that for quite long periods of time. They would try to bend it. They would do shearing, where they would cut bits off with other metals, or the same type of metal. They would just try to sharpen them on each other, iron sharpening iron, that kind of thing. And they were able to get to some usable material. This has some advantages. You don't have to build a fire. You don't have to do all of the process of setting up a forge or getting material together to get a fire hot enough. Not that they would have realized that at this early point. There's no evidence of firing stone aside from mud brick prior to this. I take that back. There is evidence that lime was fired to make plaster, but there's no evidence they were doing this with copper or gold at this point. And that's probably something they figured out later. They were like, hey, let's try and do this just to kind of, experimentation. Try to see what would happen. Another thing, with the rolling at least, usually the items had a better finish. They would shine a lot more, and that's again, part of the attraction for some of these items. Some of these items, it appears they were never actually used. They're more of a symbol or a status, at least in certain situations. Also, another thing, they also, they didn't have to worry about, you know, introducing something that would weaken the metal. In this case, it's, you know, it's naturally hard, or at least, you know, hard enough to do what you would want it to do, if you were using it as a tool. You're not going to accidentally put in too much lead or anything like that, which, again, jumping the gun on that, lead's not a thing yet. But, of course, it is. It does have disadvantages. The metal, of course, at room temperature is much harder than if it's been heated, so you have to use a lot of force, and the tools themselves may not get sharp enough or hard enough, so you may have to use more physical force to get the same type of energy output. You may have to use more force for the tool to have the same energy output than, say, a stone axe that you would use much less force with. Also, the metal is not as malleable, so it's harder to fit to certain situations. You have to use a very specific type of, grips or things like that to kind of make the tool or jewelry or weapon, what have you, to make that usable. You may have to make adjustments to other equipment, whereas with stone, you just make an adjustment to the stone. There's less standardization with cold rolling. Also, because of the nature, bending, rolling, putting force on it, you may have weakened the metal in certain places and not realized it. You're not getting damaged the integrity of the metal. There may be some residual stress somewhere that you couldn't see, and that may make the tool worthless, or at least not as productive as it could have been, or at least as productive as a stone tool. Now, after, of course, experimentation with this cold rolling, there are other methods that they developed to work this the metals. These have different names in different places, but generally they can kind of be summed up into three other types of metalworking. There's annealing, smelting, and casting. And these are all developed at different periods in different places. For this season, cold working is everywhere that has iron or has copper is using cold working. Absolutely, that's the first step that we all had. Annealing will come up, I believe, everywhere that has copper this season as well. Though some places that may not actually show up until the very, very end of this season. And what this is just, it's heating the metal. Not enough to turn it into a liquid. You're not melting it. You're just heating it enough to make it easier to bend or to shape. And I should have mentioned, I guess now, the melting points for gold and copper. Copper, you can get it to melting at about, it's like 1900, a little over 1900 degrees Fahrenheit, which is, I think, 1100 degrees Celsius. And gold is around the same, but it's, I think it's a little bit under, not by a lot. It's like 40 or 50 degrees lower than copper. Again, but not to say that they're melting it. That's just, you know, they would probably have to get it maybe half as hot, maybe even less, depending on how much they wanted to shape or reform it if they needed to. And this isn't going to help necessarily with recycling, but it would help you reuse. Like maybe if it got bent, an item like an axe head got bent out of shape, you could heat it enough to straighten it out more. That's what you would use the aniline for. It would make it a lot easier to reuse or recycle. Now, the next step in metallurgy, or at least one of the other processes, as I said, was smelting. Now, this is a little bit more debated. Most of the places that have discovered or that are entering the copper age this season, most of them are not going to get to smelting copper just yet. It'll probably happen, at least most of these places will be sometime next season when they develop smelting techniques. And the same goes for casting as well. Though the Middle East and I believe Marigar, the Indian civilizations, they do have evidence that they could have. I think it is likely, extremely likely. In fact, I'd say definite that these two regions are definitely smelting and casting this season. Other regions, again, a little bit later. But that being said, the other places, it appears that all these places are kind of doing this independent of each other, or at least they may have. At least that's the way it appears. Now, again, it could be that that's not the case, but a lot of these places kind of have their own processes of how they do things that kind of make it seem like, you know, this was developed by them and them alone, or at least, you know, they had their own methods, which typically speaking, you know, if it's diffusion, it's usually based off the single method. But, and again, this is kind of jumping in the future, but Chinese smelting and casting, they get much higher quality metals than the Middle East and Europe. Same for West Africans, at least when it comes to iron. Their iron techniques are, they get to a higher, like, I guess, grade or quality than Middle Eastern, most of the Middle East and most of Europe. Yeah, far earlier. And that's true of China, too. And, yeah, everyone has their own methods. They have their own kind of assemblages for furnaces and things like that. But that's all stuff, again, we're going to cover in the future, just because it's an example. But it appears, at least for this season, it's the Middle East that's going to be kind of the front runners in terms of, you know, metallurgy and metallurgical skill. And that's kind of going to tie in, again, to urbanization and specializations that arise from a more centralized, larger population density societies, as opposed to these wider spread groups that we'll be talking about in other parts of the world. But I think that's kind of the highlights, at least. Now, smelting, I'll go ahead and go into detail, but essentially what smelting is, you're basically adding heat to something, well, in this case it's an ore, to get a metal from something, or get it to a point where you are, maybe if you already have the metal, in the case of copper or gold or native, you know, native materials, where you're getting it to the point where it can be poured. And that also, to do that, you also have to cast. Even if you're, for casting, of course, you have a mold where you have the shape that you desire your metal to take, and you have to pour the metal into this mold, and then once the metal has cooled, you break open the mold and you pull out the cast metal, and then you kind of shave it down. You work it so that any excesses are removed from it, so it has the proper shape. And of course, you would recycle the extra bits. You'd put it in probably like a scrap pile, and then eventually you'd have enough scrap to kind of melt that down and do another casting. But smelting is the process to get it to the liquid form. And you wouldn't necessarily cast, or you wouldn't necessarily smelt something just to cast it. That's usually what happened, but it's very possible that, you know, smelting was designed to get the metal out of the ore. And that's something we'll be talking a lot about with next season's metallurgy special, where we'll go into lead, tin, silver, and how, you know, finding or trying to draw, copper from these, less native copper mixed in with those other minerals we talked about, how trying to find copper led to the discovery of other metals and their usefulness. And that's going to play into alloying and things like that. But if I kind of think that's the best explanation that I have for metallurgy, at least for this season. We'll be back next week. I think I can finally start on the urbanization and that process. And then we'll also probably have to talk about religion some, at least when it comes to urbanization. I would like to do specific religions for specific groups when we get to them. So I might hold off on that. I'm trying to decide how to do that currently. And we'll probably do a couple of weeks worth on urbanization. So I hope you're all looking forward to that as much as I am. If you have any questions or feedback or feel I missed something or didn't fully explain something properly, please let me know. You can email me at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can message me directly on Twitter. I'll post the link to my Twitter account on the episode description. You can comment on the YouTube videos where I upload the episodes there. I also stream most days during the week and occasionally on the weekends. I play generally history games, strategy games, war games, those kind of things. Occasionally throw in something else, some just random stuff. But, you know, you're welcome to come by while I'm live and ask questions there, and I'll try my best to answer, provided I'm not losing my mind at the time. But, thank you all for listening. I really appreciate it. I'm so happy the show's continuing to grow. Thank you all. I hope you have a good rest of your day and a good rest of your week. Goodbye.